I recommend highly. One day may you all take sannyas. The life of sannyas is very wonderful. Just meditating on that. The scriptures do enjoin, you know, when you turn 50, you know what it says. You move into vanaprastha and then prepare for sannyas. Hare Krishna. As a traveling sannyasi, I get to experience so many climates, so many different seasons, even in the course of a week, and different audiences, and watch devotees advance in Krishna consciousness, because you live with everybody, so you see it slow motion. I see it kind of like snapshots here and then snapshots there. Just, it's nice. And I like the message of Srimad Bhagavatam. So, you know, sharing thematically, that was mainly what I was thinking. You were sharing it at the Krishna house. I do a marathon, but for me, the marathon is sharing the wonderful message of Srimad Bhagavatam, trying to make it a little... You had such a mix at your place. That was like, I didn't know exactly what to do. But a group like this, it's easy. The message of Srimad Bhagavatam, I've been speaking successively through the first canto, second canto. I'm now canto 3, chapter 27. And understanding material nature is the chapter title. This is Kapila Dev speaking to Devahuti, his mother. Kapila Dev is an incarnation of Vishnu, incarnation of the Supreme Lord, taking the role of a Brahmana teacher, the teacher of the message of transcendence, specifically. He's a yoga avatar. That is, he's delivering the means of deliverance, the means of perfection for Satya Yuga through the process of meditation combined with transcendental knowledge, meditating upon what? If you ask people, how many people do meditation? And then how many people... Could you share what you meditate upon? It gets really colorful. So meditating upon the absolute truth. And to be able to meditate upon the absolute truth, you have to know what is the absolute truth. And the mind has to become purified. The senses have to be controlled. And the heart has to be cleansed and some preliminary things. So that's what's the part of the, what's happening here is the preliminary. He's instructing Devahuti. His final, there's a section where she asks, my husband is gone, my 9 daughters are gone, and soon you'll be gone. So before you go, please instruct me, where will I find the position of safety and shelter? And that's chapter 25, it's through the association of devotees. Satam pasangan mamabirya sambidho bhavanti rit karna rasayana katha. Nice verse. In the whole section, that chapter 25, I learned this from associating with Dravida, there's prayers. Well, at least he calls, and I believe he calls because her acharyas call, Sadhu Sangastaka. Ashtaka's 8 prayers of glorification of the relevance of Sadhu Sangha. In response to her question, after you've gone, where will I find shelter? Similar, not the same, but similar to the question of in Canto 1, Chapter 3, that sages of Naimisharanya asking, Now that Krishna's gone, where have religious principles taken shelter? So religious principles have taken shelter. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, or Srimad Bhagavatam is Paradharma, is the shelter of all religious principles. That the consummation or ultimate attainment of all religious principles. So one who takes shelter of Srimad Bhagavatam has the association of religious principles, and those who engage themselves in the topics of Srimad Bhagavatam or Krishna Katha, Hari Katha, hearing and chanting, this is the means of awakening devotion and attaining the Supreme, starting with Namanyan Tashu Yushon Kataniyat, beginning with the chanting of the holy name. And then the form and pastimes, the qualities of the Supreme Lord. So to qualify one to enter into that stage of bhakti, Kapila Deva is giving nice instructions, specifically in relation to the souls moving through the field of matter, because that's where we are. We're in this, within the cosmic manifestation. Literally, any direction you turn in, you see it's a sea of matter, and whatever channel of frequency, you know, sound or light or heat or earth or air, it's a sea of material energy in all directions. And we're to somehow within this sea of matter come to transcendence. So we have to have proper regard of things, proper regard of matter. The verse, previous verses were describing how one can see the Supreme Lord within matter, and how one can be encaged in a material body, gross and subtle, and not be inflicted with the impulses of the modes of nature and the forces of the material energy, although we're encountering them, to not identify with them, but stay fixed in transcendence. And that we just this morning heard the downside. If one doesn't, then the consequence. Just read that verse. Yeah. Well, the two verses, 15, 16. And then Devahuti starts her questions, text 17. A living entity can vividly feel his existence as the seer, but because of the disappearance of the ego during the state of deep sleep, he falsely takes himself to be lost, like a man who has lost his fortune and feels distress, thinking himself to be lost, identifying with the material circumstance. Then we lose the self. And in contrast, there's the transcendentalist. Although a devotee appears to be merged with the five material elements, the objects of material enjoyment, the material senses, the material mind, and intelligence, he is understood to be awake and freed from the false ego by dint of identifying as a spiritual entity in service of the supreme primal entity, the supreme personality of Godhead. And then this sea of material energy is something that provides an opportunity, is paraphernalia for a service to the supreme in different ways. Opportunities for serving the Supreme. And like, you know, like a businessman looking at anything thinks, how can this make some money? Just, they don't have to get primed. Okay, now you can start thinking about how to make money. This, anything they look at, it's, that's how they think. That's the mentality. or a philosopher thinks, you know, eminent abstract terms, or a controlling person wants to control and rule anything they look at. So, devotee, aside from that, whatever that psychophysical nature is, it's how something can be used in Krishna's service, according to one's position, one's nature. And that way, transcendentally situated, although encaged in the sea of material energy. So the last verse, spoken by Kapila Dev, and I'll read that and Devahuti's question, her question's very nice. This is the concluding part of this series of verses, text 16. When, by mature understanding, one can realize his individuality, then the situation he accepts under false ego becomes manifest in him. Purport. The Mayavadi philosopher's position is that at the ultimate issue, the individual is lost, and everything becomes one. And there is no distinction between the knower, the knowable, and knowledge. But by minute analysis, we can see that this is not correct. Individuality is never lost, even when one thinks that the three different principles, namely the knower, the knowable, and knowledge, are amalgamated or merged into one. The very concept that these three merge into one is interesting. Listen to this. It's another form of knowledge, and since the perceiver of the knowledge still exists, how can one say that the knower, knowledge, and knowable have become one? Cool, huh? There's still the knower and the known. The knowing, the merging, and the one who knows it. The individual soul who is perceiving this knowledge still remains an individual. Both in material existence and in spiritual existence, the individuality continues, semicolon. The only difference is in the quality of the identity. In the material identity, the false ego acts, and because of false identification, one takes things to be different from what they are. That is the basic principle of conditional life. Similarly, when the false ego is purified, one takes everything in the right perspective. That is the state of liberation. Paragraph. It is stated in Isha Upanishad that everything belongs to the Lord. Ishabhasyam idam sarvam. Everything exists on the energy of the Supreme Lord. This is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita. Because everything is produced of his energy and exists on his energy, the energy is not different from him. But the Lord still declares, quote, I am not there. When one clearly understands one's constitutional position, everything becomes manifest. False egoistic acceptance of things conditions one. Whereas acceptance of things as they are makes one liberated. The example given in the previous verse is applicable here. Colon. Due to absorption of one's identity in his money. When the money is lost, he thinks that he is also lost. But actually, he is not identical with the money, nor does the money belong to him. When the actual situation is revealed, we understand that the money does not belong to any individual person or living entity, nor is it produced by man. Ultimately, the money is the property of the Supreme Lord, and there is no question of it being lost. But as long as one falsely thinks, quote, I am the enjoyer, or I am the Lord, this concept of life continues, and one remains conditioned. As soon as this false ego is eliminated, one is liberated, as confirmed in the Bhagavatam. Situation in one's real constitutional position is called mukti, or liberation. Because we have some people here that weren't with us yesterday and so forth, a little reminder of the broader context of this whole discussion. The, the springboard, the starting question by Devahuti. She's just now going to ask some additional questions. But it was, her question was, how can I become free from the, from being overly attached to family, to the bodily, I and mind conception. I as the body and mind as the extensions of the body. Because I'm bewildered. Kardamuni, now that you are of mature age, Kardamuni has gone back to the forest. He's taken Vanaprastha, as was promised by my father when we married. And we've been together for thousands of years, because at Satya Yuga they were together for that long. I have become very attached, now he's gone. So, he's directly, the conversation, the reply is a philosophical one, but it's more than philosophical one, it's practical. It's where you repose consciousness. And where you repose consciousness is going to assist in determining the conceptions of life that you carry. So you invest consciousness in the temporary, and that's the conception that you'll carry in your mind. And you invest consciousness in transcendence, withdraw it from asat and invest it in sat, and the conception will be a spiritual conception. And then one can meditate upon and contemplate and act in devotional service under the Supreme Lord. Necessary to have a spiritual conception to properly think of Krishna. Manmana. Bhava man bhakto. Necessary to have a spiritual conception. Just as Krishna does in Bhagavad Gita, challenging or withdrawing the misidentification with the body and refixing that conception upon the eternal soul. And then the eternal soul's position in relation to the Supreme Soul. And the living entity's position in relation to matter. Sambandh again is necessary. Although some people think it's tedious. If you don't go through that effort of strengthening the intelligence, withdrawing from the material conception to the spiritual and replacing with the spiritual conception, it's going to be very difficult to progress. And difficult to progress means it's like rowing the boat and keeping the anchor in the bottom of the sea or the lake. Row, row, row. Don't go anywhere. Row, row, row. Don't go anywhere. Cut the rope or pull up the anchor, and then you can move somewhere. I'm just reading earlier today a little section from Bhakti Sandarbha. Jiva Goswami is the author. And in one section on Bhakti Sandarbha, he's discussing the role of faith in devotional service. Some people criticize faith. What's his name? Dawkins. You know, it's practically like a communist. You know, it's the opiate of the people to have faith. Where's the evidence? You know, but if you look at evidence with your material senses, then you have faith in your material senses, which can be shown to be imperfect, but still you place faith in your imperfect senses. You're going to repose faith anywhere because it's intrinsic to the living entity. It's part of the soul. The soul in its purified state has faith. The soul in the contaminated state has faith. Arjuna asked Krishna, if you don't have faith in me, people don't have faith in your words, will they not have faith in something else? In other words, is faith intrinsic to the soul? The answer is yes. According to the modes of nature, one will have faith. The false sense of independence of the Supreme means we place so much faith in our own intelligence, our own analytical abilities. And therefore, to hear with faith from scripture or higher authority, that's not evidence. My rational faculties, you know, pratyaksha and anuman, they're the means of knowing things. And the shabda thing, I know, where's the evidence? One response, a very broad response, is look at the quality of life. Look at the quality of life of people who live by the codes of theistic conduct. And look at the quality of life of people that don't. There's some evidence. Some of the younger, well, there aren't so many of the younger people who are attending universities today, but, you know, I'm sure at the university. There's the number of Chinese students in our universities in America today is so many more than before. If you go to California, I was 10 years ago, we did a program at UCLA. I couldn't believe it. I don't know what the percentage is, but something like 70%. Unbelievable. The demographics in America is rapidly changing. And one of those students came to this seminar that I was conducting in Seattle on Brahma Samhita. And, you know, in blunt language, she said, she's a, you know, graduate student, is in China, the government is teaching, there is no God, you only need science. I mean, it's not just indirectly atheistic, it's directly atheistic. Science replaces God. So I asked, and I've asked this of Chinese people, the prosperity of China has kaboomed, and over the past, whatever it is, 2 decades, has the quality of life in China improved? There's no one that will say yes. I mean, just even the quality of air, or the quality of the food, or the quality of relationships, or, you know, the quality of life. There's some evidence. Or here's some other evidence. One who applies himself with faith and with sincerity to the process of bhakti, like Prabhupada would say, becomes bright-faced. Becomes, you know, and the opposite, when someone leaves the practice of devotion and tries to, you know, do something else somehow, somewhere else, something else, their whole demeanor, their features change, become ashen, or it's the glow that's natural in the features of a sincere devotee. It's just, it pales. It's visible. Anyway. And so many studies that having more doesn't make people happier. Statistics, having more makes people more unhappy. I'm just sharing that with for the purpose of speaking to Western audiences that, you know, what's the real standard of happiness? There's so many studies because of marketing. They want to know what's going to make people buy stuff. And in sociology, what's the quality of life now? And there's, you know, this professor, that professor have done their, you know, extensive studies. One statistics professor combined with a sociology professor at Princeton University, and very humbly he called his studies after himself, the Enderline principle, Professor Enderline. And you know, there's charts of since, you know, the post World War II of what the affluence chart looks like and the happiness chart looks like. And, you know, it's a paradox, they say. It's not. And there's like, then there's studies on why it is like that and so on. The happiness doesn't increase, the quality of life doesn't increase. So supposing there's the spiritual paradigm, supposing one reposes faith in these messages, what happens with the quality of life? I'll just do a little sharing. It's not exactly on, you know, Sankhya philosophy of Kapila Dev, but it's on the principle of descending knowledge and why there's merit in accepting descending knowledge. Sariputta Prabhu, I had the good fortune of associating with Sariputta and Rabindra in different times when they were together. They're both like, of course, Sariputta is now departed from us, but they're both brilliant personalities, and to be in their company while they're discussing anything, it's, you know, just it's watching brilliance and brilliance illuminating. They get very enlivened with one another's brilliance. And both of them, Rabindra Sarup Prabhu's PhD was in philosophy, was a study of how the views, philosophical views of polity, meaning how people govern themselves, has changed from European times till now, without all the, you know, reciting his PhD thesis. Rabindra Sariputta, from his studies on, as he was given the assignment by Srila Prabhupada with study the Srimad Bhagavatam, fifth canto, to understand the principles of Vedic cosmology. Imagine being a PhD mathematician and being asked to study Vedic cosmology from the fifth canto. And he took it on. So, and part of that was to understand, I don't know if you've read Vedic Cosmology and Cosmography, that book, but it's a study of how the world's worldview on cosmology is so similar. Look at the book, and there's, you know, from Siberia to South America to Africa to Southeast Asia to Russia and Sweden and, you know, American Indians and all over the world, and, you know, China and America, all over the world. Cosmology almost identical. Some variations on the theme, but almost identical. And then those that know, the scholars that have also noticed that, they have analyzed, well, there's three possible reasons. And one of them is just we're genetically wired. That we're going, you know, human species are going to come up with a cosmology that looks like this. They say it's not so plausible. Then another possibility was it's just chance. And that's not so plausible either. And then there's a third, and that was that once upon a time there was a world culture and a shared cosmology from that world culture. They say we don't like that one. But it's of the three, it's the least implausible. It's the most likely. But they don't like that one. So there was a culture worldwide of Vedic influence. And then when the European scholars, I'm not sure the dating of all this, but there was a period of time when European scholars discovered the wisdom of the Vedas. And there was this whole wow experience amongst the scholars of Europe who wanted to go and study the wisdom of the Vedas. Then there were some Christian scholars in Europe that said, uh-oh, we have to do something about this. And so the something that they did about this was they poo-pooed Vedic wisdom and called it, you know what they called it, mythology, only just softened it a little bit and called it Indology. But you know, the subtext is it's mythology. And the scholars in particular, I mean, Sadhapunta wrote a BTG article about this. This is about faith and ultimately having faith in how to practice devotional service according to the message of the Bhagavatam, not just blindly, but with some genuine faith. Because you have to do that in order to consistently practice it. So there was a scholar, and then there was a person who carried his message around. And the scholar that wrote said, there are these two areas of Vedic wisdom that are empirical. And they, and as time unfolds, it will demonstrate that through archaeology, you know, the time, the dating of things within the Vedas was shown to be rubbish. And through the further refinements of astronomy, as technology advances, the numbers that they give of, because it's quantified, it's numerical, it's empirical information within the fifth canto. Of, you know, the diameter of the universe and the orbits of planets and all those things. The distance between this planet, that planet. It's numerical. So as technology advances and astronomy becomes more and more refined, it'll debunk all of what's in the Vedas. So therefore we can safely conclude all the Puranic information is also mythology. And there were people that went around and championed this message. That, you know, he gave the names in these articles. And that, you know, they gained some traction. The purpose was to keep the European Christians from becoming influenced by another religious tradition, the Vedic wisdom. And therefore, the importance that Srila Prabhupada gave to the fifth canto and showcasing the fifth canto for the world, that could not only provide a model, but with numbers that they're actual numbers, and modern astronomy is getting closer and closer to the actual numbers. So there's reason to have faith in the Vedas by quantifiable information. And so similarly, you know, the work that Dhritakarma has done with archaeology and findings of bones and the dating of things and all of that stuff. You know, it's very important to counteract it's like a century and a half old of people poo-pooing the Vedas and calling it bad names. But those two areas of empirical research are bringing very, very strong evidence in support of, in other words, why would the author of the Vedas that had such detailed and sophisticated explanation of the structure of the universe without telescopes, with no technology, they understood the whole workings of the universe. How do they do that? By descending knowledge. And those same persons that have that capacity of descending knowledge are going to be interested in fairy tales. Nice try. So such qualified persons are followers of these standards of not only control of mind and senses, but then having a proper understanding of sambandha again, having a proper understanding of what's what. Is it possible to be you don't have to be an intellectual and to the degree that you know all these verses and you can put all the puzzle pieces together. At least in the principle that's being presented, because this is Kapila Dev speaking to his mother. She's not, a super scholar. She's not, a PhD in Sanskrit. She's a mother. She's a great devotee, pure devotee. But she's giving her, Kapila Dev is giving her, which means he's giving us, or anyone who in the future reads the Srimad Bhagavatam, the opportunity to withdraw in a very clear, not just a belief way, but a clear and faithful way, how to fix the mind in transcendence, detached from the temporary while living within the sea of the material energy, but not identifying with it, and fully engaging in devotional service without the implications in matter. Let me just read Devahuti's next question, and I won't even go through the purport. I'll just read your question so we see the direction things are going in. Devahuti inquired, "My dear Brahmana, does material nature ever give release to the spirit soul? Since one is attracted to the other eternally, how is their separation possible?" So, stay tuned for the answer from Kapila Dev. It's by the process of yoga, by linking with the Supreme. Detachment from matter is made possible by attachment to the Supreme. Yaya samohito jiva atmanam trigunatmakam. These verses where Vyasadeva is describing the realization that he had under Narada's instruction, meditate, fix your mind upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead and what you experience, that should be the basis of Srimad Bhagavatam. He saw in that trance of meditation, apashat purusham purnam mayam cha tadapashrayam. He saw the Supreme Personality of Godhead, which means the spiritual world, because the Personality of Godhead is not alone. Wherever he is, his abode is, and his associates are, and everything is. Like Prabhupada would say, "The king is coming, the king is coming." Does that mean the king is walking down the road alone? No way. His whole entourage and the whole assembly comes with the king. So the Supreme Personality of Godhead, similarly, is not alone. He saw the spiritual world, Vyas. And he also saw the material energy, apashat purusham purnam, mayam cha tadapashrayam, under his control. It was, the material energy was behind him. Because you can't see the Supreme Lord because Maya is standing in the way. If the Supreme Lord says, "My dear Maya, please get out of the way so my devotee can see me," then she does because she's under his control. And then Vyas saw the yaya sammohita jiva, how the living entity becomes bewildered by that Maya. Atmanam trigunatmakam. Although he's made of spirit soul, he becomes influenced by the three modes of material nature. And then he saw the mitigating process. And that is when the living exactly was being described in great detail by Kapila Dev to Devahuti, and she's asking the right questions. Here's the perplexed situation of living entity How do we get out of that perplexed situation? Well, turning one's attention to the Supreme in devotion. Great, how do you do that? Well, you hear the topics of transcendence from the Supreme Lord or through his representatives, through the disciplic succession. Just as we're doing. What do we know about all these things? I remember hearing a lecture where Prabhupada was saying, when a living entity is born, we're in ignorance. We don't know even the first thing of spiritual life, like the spirit soul. We have to hear about it. Unless you're Shukadeva Goswami, that's pretty rare. There's no knowledge even of the soul distinct from the body. And there are cultures of the world, China is one of them, they don't even have a conception. Check it out sometime. You know, if you, somebody that you go, you're at school with or work with, you know something about Buddhism? Yes. Do you believe in reincarnation? Yes. Ask them, what is it that's reincarnating? And so, the identity of self is what? Not so different than people in the West who think, I'm the body. I'm the body. So the body is reincarnating, really? Well, not really. Well, then what is it really? Kapila Dev is laying the foundation very systematically for the soul becoming released from the influence of matter, which is the theme of Vyasadeva's realization, and therefore it's the thread that runs through the Srimad Bhagavatam. And then verses are embellishing or expanding upon that. So let's hear what Kapila Dev says to Devahuti tomorrow morning. Any questions or comments? Yeah.
Thank you, Maharaj. We hear that Prabhupada says that impersonal liberation is not a permanent position even if a living entity achieves it. So when the living entity comes out of the Brahman, do they have any karma or false ego left over from their previous lives, or are they entering
clean slate? Never heard a description. To come into the material world, let me contemplate what Prabhupada said about this. When the living entity falls again from Arunya Krichchena Parampadam Tada Patantyudo Yadmara Yushmad Angrayaha. And so there's impure intelligence. And you come in contact with matter and immediately you're enveloped in false ego. So in Brahman, the message we hear is that individuality is suspended. Something like deep sleep. Something like what he's saying here. There's still consciousness. There's still individual consciousness. But the individuality, the expression of that is suspended in the Brahmajyoti. So one leaves that situation, one certainly becomes enveloped in false ego. Now your question specifically, is there residual karma? I don't know of any scriptural indication that says yes or no. Common sense says no. Because to enter into the Brahmajyoti, they become, it's like sterilized. You put something into fire, it becomes fire. There's no actions of karma, there's no actions of the modes of nature. It's all suspended, neutral state. But then again, contacting matter immediately follows ego, and then plus the desire to enjoy, and one starts doing stuff, and you gather a bunch of karma. Interesting. What do you do before that karma starts to accrue? You twinkle or something. Yes. Yeah. There's more elaborate things than that also. It's a long story.
So would that apply to this?
Well, his question specifically is there karma? Is there residual karma from prior? And that, no, it's not. It doesn't address that. They accept some embodiment somewhere. But is that a karmic situation? No. Yes?
I was intrigued by you saying that faith is intrinsic. Can you explain a little bit about what someone who is self-realized in spiritual, how they use faith, or how faith interacts with the devotional service of the Lord?
They have faith in the Lord and faith in the process of serving the Lord. Kevala. Absolutely. So the faith is fully reposed in the Supreme, in their relationship with the Supreme, in the process of serving the Supreme. There's no hedging. There's no bahushaka. There's one. That oneness of love with full faith in the Beloved and the relationship with the Beloved. There's varieties of feeling because there's variegatedness within Krishna, so there's variegatedness within the part and parcel of Krishna. But it's always with full faith in Krishna. Let's take, Goloka, residents in Goloka Vrindavan, or Vaikuntha. It's especially interesting in Goloka because by Yogamaya's influence, this is a little Brahma Samhita message, but there's the sentimental assumption, the bhava, that there's danger. There's no demons, but there's the bhava that there's demons. Vibrahma vilas, in the language of Jiva Goswami. One of the four defects of the conditioned souls is to make mistakes. Bhrama, not the other one. Bhrahma. Bhrama is to make mistakes or be illusioned or error. And Vibrahma is very mistaken, illusioned. And vilas is pastimes. So there's the sense of demons, although there's no demons. And when there's the sense of demons, what happens? Where faith is reposed, that's where your consciousness goes. And it's just intensified. It amplifies the shelter and faith taking in Krishna. So they call for Krishna. It's intensification. So there's... Your question is about faith, and in responding, that what and what's it like in the realm of perfection? There's no other shelter, and yet there's impetus from time to time to increase the taking of shelter by the arrangements of the internal potency. Go ahead. You want to say something?
Doesn't necessarily imply then you don't have faith. It's really
the culmination of perfection, the mature stage of it. There's no competitor ignorance. And you're choosing knowledge instead of ignorance. But it's the mature stage. It's a relationship that's consummate.
Which takes away then the argument somehow that faith is a sign of weakness. It's faith is in its purest form when you have full strength and power and not.
Yes. Okay. You want to add to this?
I just want to, because now I'm feeling maybe also what you're feeling. So there's also uncertainty in the spiritual world, but there's search for...
It's a bhava only. There's no uncertainty.
It's created by yoga maya.
Yes, created by yoga maya.
But we have uncertainty because of maha maya.
Yes. We have nothing but uncertainty.
And we're... Because you said that word hedge and it hit perfect. Because, yeah, the holy name by... Yeah, Krishna, but yeah,
Rumaraj, but... Yeah, just in case they space out or something. I'm too insignificant. I didn't wave my arms enough. I didn't quack loud enough. You have something? Okay. Yes. That's right.
Since it cannot know everything, it has to work, function on faith.
Not because it's small, it has to work on faith. Not because it's small, it's just intrinsic to the soul. Like, you know, the living entity has qualities like Krishna, but quantity different. Krishna has faith too. He's the perfection of everything. Where does faith come from? Where does the faith of the soul come from? Now, so, like, you know, it's not like faith is, well, now I've removed doubts, so now I have faith. Removed ignorance, and now I have faith. In Krishna's case, you know, he's the absolute truth, from which everything comes, including faith. So that's kind of, you know, from Krishna's perspective, it's a little different than from our perspective. We have faith in Krishna. What does Krishna have faith in? He has faith in himself. He's the absolute truth, whatever he wants to do. So it's not just because we're small. We must operate with faith. It's intrinsic to us. There's this relationship with him. And faith in our eternal relationship with him, our relationship of love with him. He's a worthy object of our love. He's trustworthy of our love. Perfectly. It's intrinsic to the soul. It's natural. But that's not faith. That's also faith. It's faith that's nourished by experience. It's not something other than faith. It's faith in its mature state. In other words, it's intrinsic to the soul. In the spiritual world or in the material world. Whether we're conditioned or liberated, whether we're, you know, tiny or medium or big, it's intrinsic because it's of the spiritual nature. So what does that look like with Krishna? Or what does it look like with the liberated soul? That's what, you know, we were discussing before. It's not just because we're small. That was the premise of your question, if I understood right. We must operate with faith. Yes. In the spiritual world, there's yoga maya. How does the living entity misuse free will there? This is the classic question. The fall of the jiva question. That's what you're asking. Yeah, the modes of nature are not there. And Yoga Maya is there, and everything's very nice. Got it. So that's not true of the yeah, but, because we, you know, we got what the picture is. It's quite unreasonable, isn't it? There is no good reason. You can't find a good reason. That's the why part, you know, but you know, the how part is what you're asking. The how is, within the living entity, we're marginal. Correct? Marginal. And what does marginal mean? Can be influenced this way or that way. Intrinsic to the soul. Here's part, you know, two difficulties in this conversation, at least, is using our power of speculation to understand something that's beyond our power of speculation. Like if you read carefully in chapter 13, verse 23 or something like that, there's the word anadi. Adi means beginning and anadi means without beginning. And Prabhupada explains the meaning of anadi. One cannot trace back when the living entity became conditioned at such a long time. So there's two ideas with anadi. It's literally eternal, or so long you cannot trace it, anadi. So Prabhupada takes the position that anadi means so long you cannot trace it. Now, your question is, there's Yoga Maya, everything's nice, hunky-dory, Krishna's there, we're happy, and then from where does this misuse of free will come? It's intrinsic to the soul. So it's intrinsic. The capacity to properly use or misuse is within the soul because we're marginal. So there is no good reason. The reason is a bad reason. Misuse of free will. And then we continue to misuse, although we could properly use at any point in time. Same power here as there. But misuse of free will is something we continue to do. We're conditioned by it. The impelling forces, so that where there's no modes of nature, how is it possible that misuse of free will can happen? It's possible because it's the powers within the living entity. Now, we're accustomed to thinking of cause creates the effect. So something outside of the living entity prompts the living entity to misuse their free will. Or to, you know, whatever happens. There's a cause and then there's the effect. That's material. In the spiritual realm, there isn't some external cause, it's an internal misuse of free will, contemplation, which doesn't make sense, but it's raga and dvesha, coveting the position of being the center and having dvesha towards he who is at the center when it comes to this position. And then one has to rectify that disposition, that misuse of free will. A second big problem is that one, this is Bhaktivinoda Thakur, the question he writes, the question itself is misleading because it places the event within time as we know it. So like once upon a time the living entities in the spiritual world and everything's hunky-dory. And then some time passes, and for some inexplicable reason, the living entity then misuses his free will. Places that which is not an event in time as an event in time, but it's an event. We're trying to measure an event that's not in time as an event in time. There's misuse of free will, but it's not an event in time as we know it. And therefore, Prabhupada writes in that purport of where he's describing anadi, one should not try to understand this from the conditioned state. When one is liberated, one will understand. And some people don't, they're not satisfied with that. They have to keep wondering. And coming up with, you know, colorful suggestions. To such people, one might ask the question, well, let's take this other hypothesis, because some people do, and that is, some living entities are eternally liberated, and some living entities are eternally conditioned. That anadi means eternally conditioned. So what's the implication of that? The implication of that is, the Supreme Lord is whimsical. Okay, you living entities, you're with me. You living entities, you can go to hell. Now, I'll send some messages, and if you want, you can come back to me, but, you know, that's the deal. Well, how come? You know, the why question. Why would a living entity misuse their free will? Why would the Supreme Lord capriciously, you know, you one quarter living entities, you go into the material world. And it's not even an event. It says eternally. Is that the Supreme Lord? That's not the one I know. Maybe someone else knows of one that's like that, but I don't know one like that. That would be why. And the other is the living entity misusing free will. Why? It's intrinsic within the soul. Free will is there. And not a prompt from outside, not like, oh, I don't like it here anymore. Misuse of free will, overcome by the dualities of desire and hate. All living entities take birth in this material world. So what gives rise to that? That's, you know, the why and the how question. It's not discernible from our position. It's misuse of free will, period. And it is an event. It's an anadi event. It's not once upon a time event. And the same of returning. The Sanskrit phrase that uses yadrichchaya. Yadrichchaya means somehow or other. You know, the somehow or other is the association of devotees. But, well, what's the cause of the association of devotees? Somehow or other. Why do some living entities get the association of devotees and other living entities don't? How many living entities are there in Detroit? Or how many living entities are there in Troy? How many have association of devotees? Well, part of it has to do with whether we go out on Sankirtan and Harinam and distribute books and meet people. You know, it's somehow or other is in the hand of those who are carrying bhakti, who have received it. Did they distribute it? If Prabhupada didn't come to do what he did, where would we all be? Some goofy place. Some misfortunate situation somewhere. But the yadrichchaya, it's the free will of the living entity in harmony with Krishna and not in harmony with Krishna. You come in contact with someone that's in harmony with the will of Krishna, that's carrying bhakti. What's the cause? It's just the mercy of the devotee. What's the cause of the mercy of the devotee? Well, they receive some mercy, and they're. Why would we go and distribute books? It's cold out. Cause stay home. I'm comfortable. Nice and warm here. You get the idea. Somehow by the mercy of the devotees, causeless mercy of the devotees, and somehow by the misuse of the free will of the living entity, things, the conditioned state can be wound up and the conditioned state can begin. And it's a puzzle. Are you okay with the answer? Kind of? All right. You have something? No. Yes?
Maharaj was saying the example of the rowing the boat.
Yeah. Yeah.
You said that it's the material attachment.
Yeah.
But as I was just thinking, like, when I was thinking, maybe this is my material attachment, I need to work on it. While I'm working, like, a lot of impurities I see. Mm. And then
get overwhelmed.
I realize that it is the mercy of Guru and Krishna to remove it. But you said that we need to remove something, like,
Elaborate. So if you get to the stage of I recognize the anchor is holding me and I'm rowing but I'm not getting further, and then I recognize, well, it's this attachment that's holding me, and then you described, and not only that attachment, whoa, there's a bunch more attachments. Now I need the mercy of Guru and Krishna. So there's the two things, effort and mercy. Effort alone is not sufficient. Effort sincerely made illumines the reality of the additional contaminations that I wasn't aware of before. And along with the one that I was aware of, I'm trying to work on, trying to overcome. And then I can't do it on my own. So I need mercy. So it's both. The classic philosophically and Leela is Mother Yashoda trying to bind Krishna. She's trying to bind Krishna. You know, it's different than our trying to get rid of our impurities, but endeavoring for something. And she's endeavoring and she's endeavoring and she's endeavoring and she's endeavoring. It's not happening, it's not happening. Krishna sees the sincere endeavor, and Krishna can remove certain potencies and exhibit his mercy potency. It's exactly what Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says about that Leela. His Swarup Shakti and his Icha Shakti prevented Mother Yashoda from binding him. He withdrew those potencies and exhibited his Kripa potency, Kripa Shakti. So that's what you need, and I need, and we all need, Krishna's mercy. Along with our endeavor. Well, we have persons that guide us. We have our scriptures. And Krishna's within our heart, and he can also, the main factor, the main number one factor is the sincerity with which we're endeavoring. Because then from within, Krishna will make arrangements, both from within and from without, to guide us. You know, if you're heading for the ditch, someone will tell you you're heading for the ditch. Because Krishna will know that you're sincere and you want to go to him, not into the ditch. And so that message will come. I think we shared this a bit. Yes, part of the thing with persons who are heading for the ditch is they're very proud of their intelligence, and they're proud of they're proud. And so when someone taps them on the shoulder and said, excuse me, but you're heading for the ditch, they get irritated. What do you mean, what are you talking about? I'm doing just fine. Heading for the ditch. So, association of well-wishing devotees, extremely valuable, essential. Yes.
Maharaj, so for your answer for the earlier question, what I got was, of course, there's no material modes in the spiritual world. And we hear that the spiritual world is full of happiness and bliss. But then to your point of rag and vish, what I'm understanding is there's feelings like hatred and envy as well in the spiritual world. Is that understanding?
It's intrinsic to the soul. The capacity is intrinsic to the soul. Let's do this. Besides just following Prabhupada's instruction that says we cannot understand from this position, so don't try, besides from, just being contented with that one, let's do this. What does tattvastha mean? Tattvastha means marginal. And the Vedic example is where the river meets the riverbank. So there's the riverbank, and there's the river, and there's where the river meets the riverbank. So where the river meets the riverbank, what's that? Is it river or it's riverbank? It's neither, it's marginal. So we're the living entity that's marginal. And where we direct our attention, that's going to determine we're being influenced by the external potency or the internal potency, the river or the riverbank. So it's where we direct our attention. And that's the soul is both conscious and consciousness. You've heard that before? The soul is both conscious and consciousness. So where we direct our attention is going to determine which of the energies we're influenced by. And that's our marginal capacity. It's within us. It's not prompted by something outside of us. It's a capacity already within us.
So even if a soul is in spiritual world, it can create an envy.
Well, it's not exactly create an envy. It's misuse free will. Then we turn attention away from the Supreme Lord. And, you know, we're in the soup. Why would we turn our attention away from the Supreme Lord? No good reason at all. It's the marginal capacity of living entity. Yeah, but then comes the yeah, but. Yeah, but it's nice. And the living entity is blissful. I mean, you know, he gave all the yeah, buts already. So it's not reasonable. You're right, it's not reasonable. It is, but it's a marginal capacity of the living entity. And some misuse their free will. It's quite unreasonable. There's no good reason. It's dumb. Well, how can dumbness or ignorance overcome a living entity that's in the spiritual world? It's the abbot. It's intrinsic within the soul. It's a regard towards the Supreme where entering into that the consciousness of the Supreme is, I wish to be at the center. Why is he always... That's the dvesha, or raga. But there's a problem. There's someone already there. So I need another place where I can be supreme. He's smiling. Okay. He'll think about it later. You have something. Yes. Not exactly. I would use different language than put it aside. But, you know, you could say accept. There's differences. If I was just to ask for a show of hands, of those of you who are married, and in your spouse, husband or wife, you see, any of you can raise your hand and see, I see no differences between the two of us. Any show of hands? I don't see any hands. There's differences. It's not impractical. You to have a relationship, you know, of any type, there must be that, you know, an honest acceptance of differences, and then you learn to live with the person that has those differences, and to them you have differences from you know their situation, and you accept the person, and you work together. And the language that Prabhupada used that I like very much, love and trust, give and take. Real simple. Differences are going to be there. There isn't such a thing of no differences. There's differences. There's similarities and there's differences. They're like, you know, then, and then, so there's differences. That's wonderful. What's wonderful? You had something. You forgot it.
I'm going to ask you to play devil's advocate again.
Oh. You want me to play devil's advocate?
I liked it so much the first night when you did it, so now I'm taking advantage. I've never understood if both sides of that previous argument we were talking about. If both
Which one?
About how we ended up here.
Oh, that one.
If both sides accept that fundamentally it was a misuse of free will, then what is the utility of the question? I don't understand. I feel like maybe I'm missing out on something, or maybe I'm not.
No, you're just not complicated. Well, you know, somebody that's heart is simple, it's easy. But you know, somebody that's heart is complicated, it's not. Nothing is easy. Everything is complicated.
Conscious,
this is Prabhupada's statement. Conscious and consciousness. It's like sunlight and the rays of the sun. That's my understanding of that statement. Conscious and consciousness. So the soul is within the body and the soul is conscious. And pervading throughout the body is consciousness coming from the soul. The soul leaves the body, the conscious soul leaves, and consciousness leaves the body. Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
Yes,
that's right. Like light and heat are visheshas of fire.
I was mentioning that the Mayavadi say that actually the philosophy is the soul itself is consciousness. So there is no entity and an attribute. So, which is what I mean, I was confused.
By. Sure, sure. They say lots of things. You know, I would be interested, maybe because you know the terminology, I'd be interested to know in Ramanujacharya's Vishishtadvaita philosophy if he would say what I just said. Consciousness is the Vishishta of the soul. As the soul is conscious, it has its attribute of consciousness. But it's whether he says it or not, I don't know. But Prabhupada says it, and our, you know, the acharyas, it's like, you know, Bhagavan has an effulgence. And the effulgence is not separate from Bhagavan. It's an aspect or an attribute. I don't know if you would use the word Vishishta. It's, the Brahman is also the Absolute Truth, and Bhagavan is the summation of the Absolute Truth. So I don't know if the terminology Vishishta would be appropriate. For living entity is, because it may have a very specific linguistic application, like fire has its vishishtas, or water has its vishishta, or sugar has its vishishta. You know, it may have a particular linguistic application that does not fit within the spiritual paradigm. I don't know.
Just a comment, Maharaj, maybe a question. You talked about China, like how atheism is pretty much taught. I was just thinking, like, here also, like, my son goes to school, and every once in a while he comes back saying that, you know, scientists say like this, like that. Like, I was just relating to that. I was wondering, like, if you could, you know, talk a little bit about how I can talk or have a conversation.
Well, you know, he wanted to go to public school, and so he's going to public school. And when public school, there's going to be something other than the Vedic paradigm, for sure, being taught in the public school. And so what you need to be able to do to help your son be able to, you know, to manage his Krishna conscious life along with going to school, my language is have a parallel intelligence. That is, he wants to get A in his exams, so he has to know what the scientific paradigm says. So he can, you know, write the answer down on the exam and gets an A in the exam. But at the same time, a parallel intelligence that says, here's the Vedic model. And here's some of the flaws within the scientific paradigm. Now, if he says that in science class, he might not get an A in his exam. So he needs to know, you know, with discrimination power, when is it appropriate, when is it not appropriate to state the flaws in the scientific paradigm and, you know, the alternative model of the Vedic paradigm. But at least for his own sanctity, that's an extra effort that as a father and, you know, as a community to be able to help yourselves and the children who are being educated in the scientific paradigm, the atheist, explicitly atheistic, mechanistic science is what's being taught. It's not a theistic science. It's a mechanistic science. It's an atheistic science. All there is matter, and the laws governing matter, and there's nothing else. Whether it's explicit, like this girl was saying, is said in China, or it's implicit. But it's pretty clear it's not available here because you can't have God in the textbooks. Separation of church and state, by law. And try to bring God in? No. Anyway, there's courtroom battles about it. And, you know, there's more money on the side of the mechanistic science team. They've got a lot of, you know, equity. And they have a lot to defend and protect their positions. So.
It's coming sooner than I thought.
Well, you'd be prepared. And if you don't know, then you need to learn. Study those writings of those devotees who have written, you know, where's the holes in the bucket? And point out the holes in the bucket, and then give the Vedic alternatives. That's exactly the approach that Sariputta took. So you have to read his books, you have to be very thoughtful. And maybe take the association of those who have been through that before you. I know some people that have, like, invested a lot in trying to understand that for the sake of their children so they can get the proper picture. Last question. Whoops, two questions. Mataji.
When my son is a teenager and he knows what spreading the way that, and he also knows what the scientific books say, I homeschool him, so he doesn't necessarily
go
with the public school textbook, but his textbook does go with the creation. You know, it's a Christian based curriculum. But, you know, just for argument's sake, they never want to, you know, totally accept, you know, just, he plays the devil's advocate with me, like, you know.
Mommy, how do you know? Does it go like that?
He says, oh, no, they feel like this, but who knows? You know, he knows both sides, but, I don't know, they are in a state that they don't want to.
That's okay. That's healthy. You keep moving your head. We're trying to get eye contact going. There we go. Ah. No, it's him. It's not. You're okay.
And then there's this other thing. They know more than us. I mean, at least he knows more than me. So he has this feeling that I know
more than you.
So why should I accept what you're saying?
Well, well, you can give him literature that's of persons who have written that know more than him. Or you can read those literatures and explain those literatures and say, I don't claim to be a, you know, PhD in this literature, but here's my understanding. And there are such literatures. I mean, obviously, because there's parents that are doing the same thing that you're doing. Not just homeschooling, but, you know, raising children. They're getting both the Vedic picture and the, you know, the atheistic science picture. So that little presentation that I made about the merit, the veracity, the acceptability of the empiric information within the Vedas through astronomy, you know, the cosmology of picture of the Vedas, and archaeology. Those are two that are empiric, that support the Vedic model. So that might be something worth your while coming to know that will help your son in principle accept, you know, there's reason to have faith in the Vedic model. I've been in front of Indian Graduate Student Association, IGSA people, the whole room is filled with PhDs, and speak about, you know, the Vedic model of the universe that's God-centered instead of Big Bang-centered. And they're, you know, it's compelling. It's not proof, but, you know, like in the audience, for example, at the end of, you know, the Vedic cosmology, the picture of Vedic cosmology, like a little auditorium filled with PhDs or PhD candidates. And, you know, one of them saying, you know, in theoretical physics, it has been calculated down to milliseconds before the Big Bang. And then everything after that. And then I asked the question, you know, and what happens over a period of time? And he said, well, there's two theories. One theory is that matter just keeps expanding and expanding and expanding and to the point where the laws of gravity don't hold anymore and things just dissipate into nothingness. And then the other one is, what's the fellow in from Harvard University? From yesterday? Carl Sagan. That it just starts to implode upon itself and comes back to a singularity. So my response was, this is very interesting. So either this one or that one, take your pick. Everything starts with nothing, and it ends up in nothing. So where does that leave us in between? Nothing. And here's another model. Everything starts with God, it ends with God, and in between is with God. And quantifiably, numerically, empirically, everything is spotless, perfect. So which gives us the better quality of life? Which is a better model? Supposing you get all the numbers. You got an explanation. So we could ask, you know, we could ask some questions of the singularity model. Where did the singularity come from? Same as like, how does a living entity fall? Where's the singularity come from and what causes it to explode? What is this, you know, unlimited mass and a dimensionless point? Is it concept? Interesting concept. How did that happen? And then why did it explode? What's the cause of his explosion? Well, it's just chance. Okay, that's your explanation. Here's another explanation. the fact that just do it a little bit further. I did this in this Brahma Samhita class. The Vedic cosmology model was a model that the whole world held, and that was a earth-centered or geocentric model. In the 1500s or 1400s, Copernicus came along and said, no, sun-centered, revolution, all the world for like centuries, earth-centered, no, it's sun-centered. And then because he invented a telescope. And then with his telescope, he said the distance between the earth and the sun is X. And he indicated, you know, that the number may get refined as telescopes get better. So as telescopes get better, instead of being off by a multiple of 100, it was off by a multiple of 80, and then 60, and then... Now it's getting closer and closer and closer to the Vedic number. With no technology. And then the explanation of relative motion. The Vedic model is relative motion. It's from the point of observation, which is, you know, Einstein said, theory of relativity, the relative motion is relative. So the Vedic model is earth-centered, the sun is moving around the earth, and the planets are moving around the sun. And that's those islands with an inner and outer parameter. And quantifiably, the numbers of where the planet Mars as it moves around the sun, as the sun moves around the earth, those numbers of what Western cosmology says is what Vedic cosmology says. You know, modern ones. How'd they get those numbers? How'd they get the model? Descending knowledge. And those same rishis that received that descending knowledge are explaining so many other things. Take a look at that, son. It's there. It may not be something you have invested the time and taken had a grasp of. It's there. And you know, the model of what scientists say, evolution. Have him read some of Dhritakarma's books. Instead of just those. Then take a look and see what you think. If you have any questions, you can write to Dhritakarma. He'll answer questions. Of course.
They are so intertwined. You know, they just love the technology that's happening. They're so.
It has its place. It has its place. But if it doesn't have its proper place, it can lead to degradation of character, of time, and misuse of technology into all kinds of awful things. When character is missing. How do you use something that you have some fascination for? And how can it use you and degrade you? Unless you have character and quality and values inside, look out. So fascination is okay. We have a room full of people that have their careers based on something to do with technology. Sure. Well, it's nurturing their faith, and you know, and the perspective that's a God-centered perspective, and a value-based perspective. Are we done? Is that our last question? I think we're done. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.